When I was on my walk the other morning, I almost went up and knocked on a neighbor's door because he had a skeleton hanging in his tree. And I thought maybe I ought to do him a favor because, first of all, it looked like somebody had died, and obviously only a skeleton was there and had been hung in the tree, maybe by pranksters. Well, then really on a quick second thought, I realized the neighbor had hung the skeleton in his own tree, and he's getting ready for Halloween. Now, some real cheap people don't do anything more than buy a yellow trash bag, fill it with leaves, and it already has a printed face on it, and stick it out by their driveway. And that's their decoration for Halloween. I have written over the years and preached over the years about Halloween and done television programs on the subject. Very likely I will announce this sermon tape on one of my future television programs so the audience can have it and can listen to what I'm about to tell you now. You know, if we could see God, we could worship Him, we think, with a greater fervor. If we could talk to Him and hear Him talking back, we would be deeply convicted, and every time He spoke, we would be in awe. If we could send Him a letter and He would send us a return letter, we would be all trembling with excitement. If we could simply somehow communicate with and talk with God, we would feel like we were really worshiping God, and we were really sure. There wouldn't be the smallest little bit of doubt about the existence of God or about what God wants us to do. As I've said in past years, if God had written the Bible differently, instead of line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little and there a little, instead of, as Peter said, even as our beloved brother Paul, writing in his epistles some things that are hard to be understood, which they that are unlearned do wrest to their own destruction, instead of, as Jesus said to the disciples when he answered why he spoke to them in parables, because the saying of Isaiah is fulfilled in them, that seeing they see not, and hearing they hear not, neither do they understand. Make the heart of this people fat, and that they are drunken. They stagger, not with wine, but with deception. And that the Bible has been written in such a way that it can be misinterpreted. But if God had said in the New Testament, do not misunderstand, do not believe for a moment that because you are reading the New Testament, it does away with any of the Old Testament laws. Or if he had said, you will notice in the heavens that I have placed every single day a different kind of a sun. On day number one, the sun will shine as a digit one. On day number two, it will be number two. No nation, no family on earth can ever lose track of which day it is. All they've got to look up there at is this sun in the number two, and they will see it's the second day of the week. You will notice that on the seventh day of the week, it will look like a big seven, and that is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. And in it, you shall not do any work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, your maidservant, etc. Or the wages of breaking that law is death. But God hasn't done it that way. Matter of fact, the Bible says, verily, thou art a God that hideth thyself, over in Isaiah 65. And we cannot see God, and we can't talk to God. So people need to have things, rituals, costumes, occasions, special years, special months, special days, special activities that help them think about life and death and deities and what this human physical life is all about. Every one of the pagan holidays stem from a desire on the part of pagans to find God. In their own way, they wanted to get in touch with someone who had control over the afterlife, someone who controlled this life, someone who gave them babies, someone who caused the sun to move as it did, or as they thought it did, which it doesn't, they found out later, and Galileo was severely admonished by the Pope when he told him that the earth was round and was made to swear, under pain of death if he did not, that the earth was flat. But he was heard to mutter as he went out, it's round nevertheless. So when these pagans continued to give back one of their babies now and then, and they developed all of these pagan notions about the kind of a God that they worship, it involved everything from self-flagellation to piercings of the flesh to markings in the flesh, such as tattooings of a tribal or a superstitious nature, to, believe it or not, human sacrifice. I want to give you a quick article. Teenagers testing extremes of Halloween help increase admissions to hospitals. This came on October of last year from a nurse that said she gets very edgy every Halloween. In her 13 years as a psychiatric nurse, she has seen hundreds of teenagers enter the hospital with behavioral problems ranging from deep depression to attempted suicide and homicide. Has anybody got control over the air conditioning? It is icy in here, and I notice people are trying to cover up. It's very icy where I am. Thank you. Things are worse at Halloween. Rolling yards, that is the word they use for throwing toilet paper in the trees. It's called rolling yards. You didn't know that. I didn't either. I read it here. And soaping windows used to be enough to give them some excitement, she said. But today it takes more and more extreme behavior to experience the thrill. Adolescent admissions to a hospital go up around Halloween, typically with youngsters unsettled by dabbling in the occult. You see cases of self-mutilation, particularly newcomers to the occult who have participated in some kind of an initiation. The dark themes of the holiday can unmask behavioral problems, some psychiatrists say. As a general pattern, there's been an increase in hospital admissions around Halloween, particularly over the past 10 years, agreed Dr. Joseph Mahwini of San Diego, California. This other nurse was from over in Nashville, Tennessee. Mahwini, who serves on the American Psychiatric Association's Council of Child, Adolescent, and Family Psychiatry, said children who explore the occult often do so with hallucinogenic drugs. But the big problem, they all agreed, is a lack of parental supervision. At Halloween, a lot of parents feel their kids need an opportunity to be free and do their own thing. The influence of Halloween itself can be a mild form of mischief and the freedom to loosen up a little, but in the extreme, it may mean freedom to be uncontrolled and influenced by the bizarre. It can be dangerous. They went on and on about that, and about some of the extreme things that occur on Halloween, and about many people who literally ingest poison or who are dead as a result of gang or occult activity, and in some cases, in the ultimate bizarre circumstances, human sacrifices that are offered inside the United States. There are animal sacrifices, and the evisceration of animals is common practice by Satanists, and of course, Halloween is their most important day. I have written a brochure on that a long time ago. I'll give you just a couple of quick quotes from it about where we got it. We're all familiar with it. As boys and girls, we probably all indulged in it. I certainly did, even though my parents didn't approve. I simply snuck out the back door with a bar of soap in my hip pocket and went around and soaped Mrs. Green's screens. I didn't even ask her a trick-or-treat because I knew she'd tell my parents. Because I so desperately wanted to be like all the other kids in the block, I would go way out of my own neighborhood where nobody would notice me with a shopping bag and say trick-or-treat, but no way I was going to say it around my block because it would get back to my mom. I think Mom sort of looked the other way. She had to know why Teddy and Dickie were missing for an hour and a half or two after sunset on Halloween, and she probably discovered the candy we brought back. And I do remember in a church basement bobbing for apples. You ever bob for apples in a wash tub? With your little head upside down, trying to trap it against the side of a huge wash tub with water filling your nose, cutting your lip, and bleeding all over the place. We did these things. In this book called Halloween Through 20 Centuries by Ralph Linton, it says, Halloween long antedates Christianity. The two chief characteristics of ancient Halloween were the lighting of bonfires and the belief that this is the one night in the year during which ghosts and witches are most likely to wander about. History shows that the main celebrations of Halloween were purely druidical, referring to the pagan priesthood of the Druids of Ireland and Western Europe. And this is further proved by the fact that in parts of Ireland, October 31st is still called Oidic Shamha, or the Vigil of Shaman, or Samhain, another name in Irish or Gaelic for the devil. Saman, and it's interesting, isn't it, that even in the Indian languages of the Plains Indians, the witch doctor was called the shaman, and that a fake doctor of medicine is called a shamus sometimes. It's kind of interesting. He was called the Lord of the Dead. He's supposed to be an evil demonic spirit of the underworld that had charge of the departed souls. And the Druids believed that and thought that by putting an offering outside on that evening, they could entice these wicked spirits, or Samhain, to give the departed souls of their loved ones who had been consigned to spend all last year inside of a cat a lesser sentence. Maybe they could become a German shepherd or something. Going on with the quote, the ancient Romans held a festival in honor of Pomona on November 1st, which is in effect a harvest festival. The winter stores of fruits, nuts, vegetables, and other produce played an important part in that festival to a pagan god. Speaking of the development of the custom in the American continent, Linton said, quote, the American celebration rests upon Scottish and Irish folk customs, which can be traced in direct line from pre-Christian times. Although Halloween has become a night of rollicking fun, superstitious spells, and eerie games which people take only half seriously, its beginnings were quite otherwise. The earliest Halloween celebrations were held by the Druids in honor of Samhain, Lord of the Dead. One more quick quote. In the book of Halloween by Ruth Kelly, she said, the Druids believed that the soul, quote, passed from one body to another at death, and they believed that on the last night of the old year, October 31st, the Lord of the Dead, Samhain, gathered together the souls of all those who had died in the passing year, and had been condemned to live in the bodies of animals, to decree what form they should inhabit for the next 12 months, and they could be coaxed to give lighter sentences by gifts and prayers. Guess what I found on the internet just last night as the Sabbath came on? Under Yahoo News, I found that all I've got to do is just, and here are all the addresses here, I can get the Halloween Costume Center, ideal costumes for families and teens. I can tune in to a huge parade and about how some in the village are spooked as a result of it. I can find out about a romantic Halloween, where to go to have a romantic Halloween holiday. And then I can find Absolutely Halloween, a 3D haunted house project, how to set that up in your own home. Puzzles, and a ghost office. And then I can find out about party suggestions by Billy Bear's Halloween, or Halloween, fearful facts to witches brew. I can find out about jack-o'-lanterns and carving great pumpkins, it says here, or trick-or-treat and certain haunted Halloween recipes. I can get pumpkin recipes, and I can get hot cross black widows, ghost cookies, and other fun treats. That's on the internet. But of course, you can get that in your local store as well. Well, if you've been to a grocery store lately, you've seen that Halloween is already festooning all the stores and markets, and people are decorating their yards with it. And, of course, if there is no God, so what? Let's all do it. I don't know what kick you get out of it, what people really expect other people to think when they drive by your yard and see a bunch of yellow trash bags with leaves in them with a grinning face on it, or what they think when they see a skeleton hanging out of a tree. But I'll tell you what I thought when I was in Craig, Colorado years ago. I never hunt on God's Sabbath day, but for all of these 35, 45, whatever years that I've been able to go hunting, the deer season or the elk season always opens on a Saturday. Well, I always get to Craig a couple of days early, and nearly always the very first day of hunting season is about the first, second, or third or so of November for what they call the late combined season up there. So on two or three occasions, I've happened to be up in northwestern Colorado when it was Halloween. I was in a Holiday Inn, and in the lounge next to the restaurant in the Holiday Inn, they were having a Halloween party. And I looked in there, and there was, I think it was a woman, I'm not sure, sitting against the wall, who could barely move because she was dressed like a mummy. And she was wrapped in gauze or ace bandages with plaster of Paris on it or something, and only the eyes and a place to breathe and a little bit of a mouth was visible, and she just sat there. So people could go by and they could see this thing and wonder what was in there, and I cannot imagine the mindset that would cause someone to go out in public dressed or gotten up like this, as if it were a mummy. It didn't scare anybody. Everybody thought, what an idiot, you know, what an idiotic idea to show up in public like that. Well, you might think that paganism is reserved only for pagans. Well, wrong. If you will turn to 1 Kings, the 11th chapter, you will find that sometimes there are other things at work. And sometimes some of the most, you think, wise, solemn, and godly men can do strange things when they get a little older and listen to some of the concubines or wives that they have married. Chapter 11, verse 3, or 4, rather, of the book of 1 Kings. It came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Eternal his God as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth. That is pronounced Ishtar also, and it's found today with a silent H in the word Easter. It's the very same goddess that is really Semiramis, the mother-wife of Nimrod, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, or Malcolm, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Eternal. This is not the common scripture that we're used to in reading about Solomon, is it? We read normally Proverbs, or we read Ecclesiastes, and we read the wise things he said when he was younger and in his middle ages. We don't read what happened when he got up into his late 80s or whatever it was. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal and went not fully after the Eternal as did David his father. Then did Solomon build a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon. And likewise did he for all his strange wives, and there were hundreds of them. So all over Jerusalem were these little tempietos, little temples, little alcoves, just like you will see in any Latin-speaking, Spanish-American, Central American country or Mexico. Along the wayside, you will see all over the place a little alcove. There will be the picture of La Virgen de Guadalupe, or maybe the Virgin Mary or something. And there will be a lot of little flowers and maybe some little candles there. And people will go by and simply cross themselves and put a flower or some candles there, which symbolizes prayers. It said, likewise did he for all his strange wives, which burnt incense and sacrificed unto their gods. And the Eternal was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned from the Eternal God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice. Oh, now, wait a minute. Are you familiar with those occasions? Keep your place there, but let's turn to 1 Kings 3 and verse 5. We always think that if God would just appear to us, we would never forget. If God would talk to us, we would really worship him more fervently. We would really cleave to his truth and never stray from the straight and narrow that he teaches us. It says in chapter 3 of 1 Kings and verse 5, in Gibeon, the Lord, the Eternal, appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said, ask what I shall give thee. And Solomon said, you have shown unto your servant David, my father, great mercy, according as he walked before thee in truth and in righteousness and in uprightness of heart with thee, and you have kept for him this great kindness, that you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is in this day. And now, O Eternal, my God, you have made your servant king instead of David, my father, and I am but a little child. I don't know how to go out or come in, and your servant is in the midst of your people which you have chosen, a great people that cannot be counted or numbered for multitude. Give, therefore, your servant an understanding heart. He didn't ask for money. He didn't ask for material goods or things that most people might. He wanted wisdom, as it says in a margin, understanding heart, a hearing, listening, understanding heart, to judge your people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this, thy so great a people? And the speech pleased the Eternal that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said, because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself long life, neither have you asked riches for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself concerning or understanding to discern judgment. Behold, I have done according to your words. Lo, I have given you a wise and an understanding heart, so that there was none like thee before thee, neither after thee shall any arise like unto thee. I have also given thee that which you have not asked. So he added riches and honor, so that there shall not be any among the kings like unto thee in all thy days. And if you will walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments, as your father David did walk, then I will lengthen thy days. And over in 1 Kings, the 9th chapter, in the 2nd verse, after the building of the temple, it said, the Eternal appeared to Solomon the second time, as he appeared unto him at Gibeon. And the Eternal said unto him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication that you've made before me. And there is that beautiful prayer that was, by the way, repeated audibly and was then printed in the newsletter that Gershon Solomon has sent out. He stood there, and in the audience of perhaps 60 to 100 people, I'm not sure how many turned out, and it did fizzle, as I said it would, when Gershon Solomon in the Temple of the Mount Faithful tried to take the stone and actually put it up into the Temple Mount area as a cornerstone for the building of the third temple. They were allowed to put it on the truck and go around the outside of the city gate 7 times. They also went around the stone 7 times, blowing the shofar. They did anoint the prayer cloth that they put over it. They did have the priests there walking in their garments. They had like a demonstration. But the police were very, very evident, and the IDF, and they would not allow them to walk on up onto the Temple Mount. And I told you way in advance that I thought that's probably what would happen, because I knew, as I told you about the Intifada and the riot that had taken 19 young Arab lives when that was first attempted, that very likely Gershon Solomon, named after Solomon here in the Bible, would not be able to do that. So he wasn't able to. But he stood there and read all of what you see in chapter 8. And the prayer, the dedication prayer of Solomon at the completion of the temple. The Eternal said, verse 3, I've heard your prayer and your supplication that you have made before me. I've hallowed this house which you have built to put my name there forever, and mine eyes and mine heart shall be there perpetually. And if you will walk before me as David your father walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness, to do according to all that I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom upon Israel forever, as I promised to David your father, saying, there shall not fail thee a man upon the throne of Israel. But if you shall at all turn from following me, you or your children, and will not keep my commandments and my statutes which I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel out of the land which I have given them, and this house which I have hallowed for thy name. Oh, Solomon, please, honey. Please, sweetheart. Oh, but you gave Judy her little god, and you gave Harriet her little god, and Jacqueline's got one. How come I can't have one, sweetheart? By the dozens, one after another, wives and wives and concubines. And he's an old man, and he's worried about being old. And they were young, luscious, good-looking women. And Solomon was very, very willing to give them what they wanted. So he built all the little tempietos. Back in chapter 11, it says the Eternal was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned from the Eternal God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice. So the appearances, and hearing the voice probably of a divine messenger, meaning an archangel, and then seeing all the blessings of God that were poured out upon him, and being wealthier probably than any human being at any time in all of the history of the world, when the years passed, it got to be old, and it faded in his memory. And so, eventually, the here and now and the little young wives and concubines were more important to Solomon than what had happened so many years, maybe 30, 40, 50 years earlier in his life. And it said, then the Eternal said unto Solomon, verse 11, forasmuch as this is done of thee, and you have not kept my covenant, my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely rend the kingdom from you and give it to your servant. So we heard earlier that he said a perpetual promise, just like to David, that his seed would sit on the throne of Israel. This begins the divided kingdoms then of Israel and Judah. Jeroboam inherits the entire northern 10 tribes, and Rehoboam, Solomon's son, has only Judah with a little tiny portion of Benjamin, and of course Levi and Simeon that were scattered throughout all the 12 tribes. Notwithstanding, in your days I will not do it for David my servant's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of your son. Howbeit, I will not rend away all the kingdom, but will give one tribe to your son for David my servant's sake, and for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen. The reason God puts the first two commandments where he does, I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. And then the second commandment, thou shalt not make unto thyself any graven images or any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above or the earth beneath or the waters under the earth. For I, the eternal thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto the thousandth generation of them that love me and keep my commandments. He didn't place the seventh one first or the tenth one first. He placed the first one first and the second one right immediately behind it, which bears upon the same thing. Why? Well, let's go over to the book of Acts right quickly, to the 17th chapter. I don't know how many of you have traveled extensively. I have been all the way around the world. I've been to Japan many times. I've been to the Middle East many times. I've been to Central and South America, to every country there. I might have missed Belize. I believe it's the only one I missed. And I've been to all of those Central and South American capitals. Been to all of the Catholic countries and the Shintoists and the Buddhist countries and the countries where Islam reigns supreme, and countries in Africa where the Xhosa, the Igbos and the Hausas and the Matabele and all the various tribes have their animism. In the 17th chapter, it says, Paul, as his manner was, verse 2, went in unto them, this was in Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scriptures, opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus whom I preach is Christ. Well, the Jews were moved with envy, it says in verse 5. They found Jason and certain brethren and drew them to the rulers of the city. And verse 6, interesting, these that have turned the world upside down are come hither. Well, what they were doing is turning the world right side up. The absolute upside down pagan abominations of these people in these cities through which the Apostle Paul traveled, well known by their bacchanalian orgies and even some of the most obscene practices that you can imagine, which I won't go into out of the pulpit or on this tape, but which they did, whom Jason has received, and these all do contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there's another king, one Jesus. Well, you know, the Caesars were worshipped as if they were God. It talked about how those, when they were sent away to Berea, were more noble, verse 11, than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the Scriptures daily whether these things were so. Well, from Berea they went to Athens, and verse 16, while they were at Athens, Paul's spirit was stirred in him when he saw this city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore he disputed in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons and in the market. And that would be the agora. You've heard of agoraphobia, which is a fear of being around in public. And the agora, as they had then, like a flea market. The market was a place like a truck farmer's market out in a public square. There weren't permanent shops as we have them today. And you could draw quite a crowd if you got in any kind of a religious discussion. And in the market daily with them that met with him, then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him. And some said, of course, in their supercilious hauteur, what will this babbler say? Others some, he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, and that was up on Mars Hill, where they had the great temple of Mars. May we know what this new doctrine is whereof you speak, for you bring certain strange things to our ears. We would therefore know what these things mean. For all the Athenians and the strangers which were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. So Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, you men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are too superstitious. And it is not a put-down. He is not trying to get himself killed. He is really saying or emphasizing, I perceive that you are most or very superstitious. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, interesting language, or the gods that you worship, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God, whom therefore you ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you, God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, either by the artificer or the sculptor, or by the priest who stands up there making funny signs with his hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things, and is made of one blood. He knew something it took the scientists hundreds and hundreds of years to find out, that it doesn't matter whether you're black, yellow, white, or brown, that the blood types are all the same, and that we're of one blood. All nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and have determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. And that's true, the overspreading of the children of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, that they should seek the eternal, if happily they might find after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of them, of us. For, this is interesting, in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. Interesting that Paul knew some of the poetry and some of the literature of the Areopagites. He was not only educated at the feet of Gamaliel and was, as he said himself, an Hebrew of the Hebrews and knew the Old Testament backwards and forwards, but he also knew a lot of the pagan literature. He was a man who was, in a sense, worldly wise without being worldly. He was well educated, and he was able, therefore, to give these people quite a witness. In past years, people have put an interpretation on this that Paul was somehow speaking down to these people. Like he was saying, him you ignorantly worship, like you ignorant fools, and then powerfully, him declare I unto you. Well, not really. He is acknowledging that they are seeking after the one who gives life and the seasons and controls what happens when we die. And he is saying, him whom you ignorantly worship. The emphasis is they were worshiping him, but in ignorance. So he's saying, I will declare him unto you. And what does he launch into? But a dissertation about the creation, about the fact of the universe, the solar system, this earth, and all life upon it. And then says, in him we live and move and have our being. It helped one young man that he told me recently. I told him on one occasion that airplanes swim in a sea of air, because I think he'd had difficulty when he first began to fly on commercial aircraft. And of course, when I read a book one time, I've done this two or three times, I'll tell my wife, I just throw the book away, because having accumulated over 7,000 hours in many, many different types of aircraft and jets, when I'm reading a book about flying and someone said they hit an air pocket, I just take the book and throw it away. I can't stand it anymore, because anybody that is that ignorant, I just don't want to read the book. But anyway, people for decades have passed on to other people the absolute myth that there are areas in the air where there isn't any air. That there are, you're going along through the air and there's this bubble, I guess, where there isn't any air. Well, pray tell, what is there if there isn't any air there? But they believe in air pockets. I'll ask people, you know, do you have a nice trip? Oh, yeah, but we hit a few air pockets. I think I remember my wife was with me, and I remember once a stewardess even said that. And I walked up to the stewardess and said, there are no such things as air pockets. There are updrafts and downdrafts. There is turbulence, but it's solid air. Believe me, there aren't any holes. Well, there isn't any air. Not like a Swiss cheese out there. Well, fish don't swim along in a lake or the ocean or a river and suddenly come to an area where there's no water and just fall until they encounter some more water. People think you're flying along in an airplane, you encounter an air pocket, and you just fall until you find some more air. What if the air pocket goes all the way to the ground? I mean, you must be sitting there just sweating it out. But there aren't any such things as air pockets. Now, I'm leading up to something here, because I cannot get away from air. I move my hand, there it is, I feel it. I go like that, I feel it. It says, in him we live and move and have our being. Oxygen. It's in this room. It's everywhere. Thanks be to billions of diatoms in the sea and the little Venetian blinds on the underside of every leaf, which open up and close depending upon the temperature, and which cause a phenomenon to occur which is absolutely contrary to the laws of gravity and that is liquid flowing upwards because of the gradual giving off of moisture by those leaves and the absorption of carbon dioxide and then the production of oxygen. Animal life gives off the carbon dioxide, and plant life and diatoms in the sea absorb it and produce oxygen. And in that oxygen, just like a solid sea that is a blanket called the atmosphere, we live and move, and we fly, and we drive, and we hit a golf ball, or we fan ourselves, or a storm blows the leaves around in our backyard. My heart is beating right now. Isn't that nice? For me, it is. Salt tastes good. Isn't that nice? For me, it is, because my body has to have it. If salt tasted like maybe sulfur or something really obnoxious that you could think about, yet my body had to have it, that would be really awkward for me. Now, if you look at the fact that God's prophets, I want to give you a couple of examples, continually emphasize God's creation. Let's read the rest of this. In him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your own poets have said, for we also are his offspring. For as much then as we are the offspring, the children of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's device. And the times of this ignorance God winked at. He put up with it for a period of time. But now commandeth all men everywhere to repent, because he has appointed a day in the which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he has given assurance unto all men in that he has raised him from the dead. Now some of them thought he was crazy, some of them mocked him, others said, we will hear more of this matter. So Paul left them. Howbeit, verse 34, certain men clave unto him and believed, among which was Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. Go back to the book of Job. Some think, and I'm not certain of this or not, you know, you can see that the J has not only the hard sound, but a Y sound or even a CH sound in some languages. And the B can be almost like a P in some languages as well. If you've studied foreign languages, you know that that is true. Back in the book of Job, some think that Job was originally pronounced Chops. And when they see that the great pyramid of Cheops, or Chops, was built by someone with great wisdom, it has actually been proposed that Job was in fact the builder of the great pyramid. I don't know if I can prove that, but I do know that after the lengthy book of Job, in which Job's tormentors, supposedly his friends, continually told him he must be wicked, he must be evil, they couldn't spot any more than Satan the devil could the real sin of which Job was guilty, which was self-righteousness. That is a common sin, and it's awfully hard for those who are afflicted by it to ascertain, to determine. When someone is self-righteous, as Job said constantly, my righteousness I maintain, it's impossible for them to see it. Now, I won't read all of these chapters, beginning chapter 38, but notice how Job was challenged by God, who then began to tell him about creation, about how it works. He says, verse 3, gird up now your loins like a man, I will demand of thee, and answer you me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? How much do you know about our earth? How much do any of us know? I was reading about the Mato Grosso, which is rapidly disappearing, but it is still one of the vastest, gigantic rainforests on the face of the earth, down in Brazil. And that every single year, there are hundreds and hundreds of brand new species of insects and creatures being discovered. When you read of the vastness of the Amazon, you know that the Amazon jungle, the Mato Grosso, the rainforest of Brazil, is bigger than the continental United States of America. When you read about the size of the Amazon River and how far that fresh water can be detected hundreds of miles out into the Atlantic. When you read about the sheer mass of vegetation and vegetable material and of all of these rivers, some of which flow together like one that is very brown, the other that is almost sky blue, and the water does not even mix for many, many miles past Manaus, where I flew with my wife and some others and landed in the Falcon jet. That is a fabulous part of the earth. Actually, men know less right now about the depths of our oceans than they do about the surface of the moon. It's a fact. They have discovered more about the moon. They know now the rocks of which it is made and of which it consists. I've seen some lunar rocks, amazing to look at JPL up in California, where samples were brought back from the Apollo shots. But they know very little about the Earth itself, especially some of the creatures in the depths of the sea. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if you have understanding. Who has laid the measures thereof, if you know, or who has stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof? In other words, what do you know about the velvety pull of the gravitational field of the sun? And what do you know about the entirety of the solar system? What do you know about this earth and how it works? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy, a time when God brought forth the physical material creation. Or who shut up the sea with doors when it brake forth as if it had issued out of the womb, very metaphorical and colorful language. When I made the cloud the garment thereof and thick darkness a swaddling band for it and break up for it my decreed place and set bars and doors and said, hitherto shall you come, but no further. Isn't it interesting that the Suez Canal and, of course, the Panama Canal at our different levels of the sea, and that there has to be many, many, many locks through which the ships have to go from one side to the other. And there's some fascinating, interesting things in studying, for example, the Japanese current, the Humboldt current, and some of the currents of the oceans, and, of course, the weather pattern. The Solomon himself knew that the weather patterns rushed toward the south, rose, went up, rushed toward the north, came down, and came back from an northerly direction back toward the equator, and said as much. But he wasn't that much of a naturalist that he knew anywhere near as much as is available by the study of the earth today and the geophysical sciences. And said, hitherto shall you come and no further, and there shall your proud waves be stayed. Almighty God set the continents where they are. He caused the tectonic plates to stretch the way they did. He caused the principle of isostatic pressure to maintain the depth of the mountains and the depth of the mountains beneath the mountains over the floating magma of the earth so that it's sort of reciprocal. And he is the one who caused the core of the earth to be like molten magma, who knows how many thousands of degrees centigrade, so that it's like liquid molten rock, and that there is a portion of it in the very core of the earth, which some have said might be nickel, or some kind of a substance, and they tried to determine this by earthquake waves because there are three ways in which earthquake waves are determined, but one of which is not through the earth. They cannot have a seismograph on one part of the world which then detects by an earthquake shock wave that goes straight through the world. It is somehow absorbed. But it can bounce off that core of the earth and be detected, and it can also be detected by rippling around the surface of the earth in the tectonic plates. But there are fascinating things to study into in geology and in the physical sciences. I won't read all of this because there is so much of it, but look at what he said, chapter 39, verse 1. Knowest thou the time when the chamois, or the wild goats of the rock, bring forth? Or can you mark when the hinds do calve? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Do you know the time when they bring forth? They bow themselves, they bring forth their young ones, they cast out their sorrows. Their young ones are in good liking. They grow up with corn. They go forth and return not unto them. Who has sent out the wild ass free, and who has loosed the bands of the wild ass, talking of things like zebras or wild horses? Whose house have I made the wilderness and the barren land his dwellings? He scorns the multitude of the city. It's very poetic. Look at verse 13. Did you give the goodly wings unto the peacocks, or wings and feathers unto the ostrich? And then showed the kind of a foolish bird that an ostrich can be, that leaves her eggs in the earth and warms them in dust and forgets that the foot may crush them or that the wild beast may break them. She is hardened against her young ones as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without fear, because God has deprived her of wisdom. Neither has he imparted to her understanding. Verse 26, does the hawk fly by your wisdom and stretch her wings toward the south? I was looking out my window when we were down at Panama City, and there was a sea eagle that was flying around. A seahawk, some might call it. And it actually went down, I watched it happen twice, and snatched a fish right out of the water with its talons, and then about three seagulls were following along, chasing it, trying to take the fish away from it. Saw that happen twice just looking out my condo window when I was down on the Gulf, and it was fascinating to watch that. Does the eagle mount up at your command and make her nest on high? She dwells and abides on the rock, upon the crag of the rock, in a strong place. From thence she seeks the prey, and her eyes behold afar off. I'll say they can be up there about 2,000-3,000 feet and see a little mouse running along on the ground when you wouldn't see anything. Her young ones also suck up blood, and where the slain are, there is she, like an eater of carrion. Moreover, the Eternal answered Job and said, shall he that contends with the Almighty instruct him? He that reproves God, let him answer it. And Job answered the Eternal and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer thee? I will lay my hand upon my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yea, twice, but I will proceed no further. Then answered the Eternal unto Job out of the whirlwind and said, gird up your loins now like a man. I will demand of you and declare you unto me. Did he go into history? Did he go into theological arguments? Did he go into pagan theology? No. He portrayed to Job the power of this creation, of great creatures and of the world. Look at what he said about Behemoth, verse 15. They think it was perhaps an elephant. I don't. I'm beginning to wonder whether or not this was at a time when there were creatures still extant that are now no longer extant and that are extinct. Because when you read of some of these creatures, it's just amazing. Some of them are thought to be like a gigantic rhinoceros or maybe a gigantic aquatic amphibian creature of some kind which could lie in the fens but then rush into the water, and so the description seems to be. Behold now Behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. Lo now, his strength is in his loins, and his force in the navel of his belly. He moved his tail like a cedar, so it sounds like even like a brontosaurus or some kind of a creature that would have a tail so big it would be like a cedar tree. The sinews of his stones are wrapped together. His bones are as strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. If you've ever been to the Natural History Museum, either in Los Angeles or the huge big one in Chicago, then you've actually seen Tyrannosaurus rex and Brontosaurus and some of the bones of these huge big animals that are now extinct. But did they live in the time of man? And the answer is yes. There have been crude spear points and arrow points that have actually been found in the bones of creatures that lived, that such as the woolly mammoth and great creatures far bigger than any of the creatures that we have today. And we know that gigantic rhinoceri or rhinoceroses, however you pronounce it, were extant in California because they got trapped in the La Brea tar pits. We also know that the saber-toothed tiger, which is about three times as big as modern tigers today and had great teeth about 6-7 inches long, was extant in the time of man. He is the chief of the ways of God. He that made him can make his sword to approach unto him. Surely the mountains bring him forth food where all the beasts of the field play. He lieth under the shady trees in the covert of the reed and fens. That's a swampy, marshy area. The shady trees cover him with their shadow. The willows of the brook compass him about. Behold, he drinketh up a river and hasteth not. In other words, he doesn't have to fear and to run because there's nothing of which he is afraid. He trusts that he can draw up Jordan into his mouth. He taketh it with his eyes. His nose pierceth through snares. Some thought a massive elephant, maybe a mastodon or something. Can you draw Leviathan with an hook or his tongue with a cord which you let down? Something so big that no man could capture it in that way. I, again, will not read all of this. Down in verse... Let's go to verse 19. Out of his mouth go burning lamps, and sparks of fire leap out, looking like a dragon, but I think that has to do with just like a huge blue whale that comes up, and the plume of hot breath that then condenses in the air, or perhaps an animal that lived in a northern climate, and it was just talking about the breath that you could see. Out of his nostrils goeth smoke, as out of a seething pot or cauldron. His breath kindleth coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. In his neck remaineth strength, and sorrow is turned into joy before him. The flakes of his flesh are joined together. They are firm. They cannot be moved. His heart is as firm as a stone. Yea, his heart is a piece of the nether millstone. When he raises up himself, the mighty are afraid. By reason of breakings, they purify themselves. That's obscure in the Hebrew. The sword of him that layeth at him cannot hold. The spear of the dart or the habergeon. He esteems iron as straw and brass as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him free. Sling stones are turned with him into stubble. All of this over and over and over again. Look at verse 31. He maketh the deep to boil like a pot. He maketh the sea like a pot of ointment. He maketh the path to shine after him, leaving a wake. He is in his apparently diving into the ocean, such a boiling wake so huge, so big, so powerful, that it's like a ship that is passing. One would think the deep to be hoary or boiling or whitish. Upon earth there is not his like, who is made without fear. He beholds all high things. He is the king over all the children of pride. Three chapters in which God starts with the earth itself, its foundations, with all the creatures upon it, from birds to fish to great gigantic behemoths, perhaps whales, gigantic rhinoceros or elephants or mastodons or mammoths or even dinosaurs, and continues on that theme until this occurs, chapter 42. Then Job answered the Eternal and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from you. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not, things too wonderful for me, which I knew not. Here I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me, I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear. Oh, men can sit around and philosophize, and they can speculate. They can talk about the way God is, and certain attitudes about God, and the way we ought to worship God, and all kinds of dozens of arguments. But now mine eye seeth thee. How? How did his eye see God? Jesus said, no man has seen God at any time. I'll tell you how he could say, now mine eye seeth thee. Just the way you can when you read a book or you stand in awe of the author's ability and of his ability to portray characters and situations, and you realize that this is a marvelous author. Just the way when you stand in awe of a painting, an old master or a modern, not modern art, but a living painter that is a fabulous artist, and say, I couldn't even begin to approach under that kind of talent and ability, and you realize that painting was done by someone with incredible artistic ability. Like an architect who designs a beautiful building, an engineer who designs a fabulous jet airplane, like a watchmaker who puts together a fabulous fine Swiss watch. You know that there was a maker, a designer, an artist, a sculptor, someone with great mind. So when you look into the symbiotic relationship in all creatures, really, because none of us lives or dies unto himself or herself, all of us must maintain this life by the taking of literally tens of thousands of lives through the course of our lifetime. And I've said before, if you could have a freight train go by and it were laden with all the sheep and the cattle and the fish and all the vegetables and all the grains and all the foodstuffs that you have consumed that have come in here, and not to finish the sentence, to keep you alive. If you could even look at a gigantic gas bag, a balloon that is absolutely as big as the state of Massachusetts, that represents the air you have breathed, if you could look at all that it has taken to keep you alive for the term of your lifespan up to this time, and the fact that now, this evening, you're going to have to ingest some more of the produce of this world, of the flesh, of some of the vegetables, it's called pulse in the Bible, of the grains, of the liquids that had to live, that had a life, and had to be plucked up, had to be cut off, had to be harvested, had to be killed and processed in order to provide food for your palate to keep you alive. Truly, in him, we live and move and have our being. And truly, he is not far from us. He is only a thought away. He is also only an observation away. All you have to do is to look at a rose, pick a petal, and look at the color. All you have to do is to look at a little sprig of ivy in your own home and see that little kind of button that's kind of coming out from where the leaf and the stalk join. That's a potential root. Cut it. Bury it. It'll put down a root and start more ivy. Isn't that marvelous the way that works? Study little clownfish and sea anemones and look at that symbiotic relationship. Any other fish that comes close, poisoned immediately, killed and eaten by the anemone. But the clownfish, absolutely oblivious. It rushes out, grabs prey, comes back and nestles in the poisonous arms and tentacles of the sea anemone to eat its prey, and in the doing of it, drops little bits and pieces, so the anemone is blessed with food, and the clownfish has a safe haven and a place to hide. Time and time again, and I'll complete this now by going over to the first chapter of the book of Romans, God's apostles, even in prayer, you remember when they were arrested and put in jail, as a matter of fact, and were in fear of their life, they said, "Thou who made the heavens and earth and the sea and all that in them is, now behold their threatenings," and they addressed him as the Creator. In verse 18 of chapter 1 of the book of Romans, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth, as it should read, in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it unto them. For the invisible things of Him, verily thou art a God that hideth thyself, and no man has ever seen God at any time. The invisible things of Him, from the creation of the world, the physical creation, are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they're without excuse. And those who turn to pagan practices and think that God doesn't see it, and that it's just frivolousness and fun, and worship death and the devil at a time called Halloween, are also completely without excuse.